Welcome to the politicalbetting.com polling matters show. My name is Kieran Pedley. And we're back in the flesh this week, and rightly so. It's been a momentous day in British politics. David Cameron has resigned, and the Queen has invited Theresa May to be the new Prime Minister. But what an inbox the new Prime Minister has. Having voted to leave the European Union 3 weeks ago, Theresa May now faces a daunting task of satisfying those that voted to leave whilst uniting the country. Some may say even an impossible task. Meanwhile, on the opposition benches, the Labour Party seems to lurch from one crisis to the next. Yesterday, the NEC ruled that Jeremy Corbyn will make the ballot in any future leadership contest, but it's not quite clear who his opponent will be. On today's show, we'll be discussing the new Prime Minister's entree, but also what happens next to the Labour Party. This week, I'm joined, as ever, by Leo Barassi from Noise of the Crowd. Hello, Leo.
Hi, Kieran.
And our regular sort of contributor slash friend of the show, Asa Bennett from The Telegraph.
Hello.
Asa, welcome. So, Asa, I'll start with you. Obviously, a momentous day in British politics. What's your reactions to the events we've seen today, but also Theresa May's speech?
Well, it's been very exciting over the last fortnight, because I think as the Prime Minister, well, the ex-Prime Minister, I should correct myself, said at his swan song...
Still feels strange, doesn't it? Whereas early, I suppose.
I have to sort of pinch myself when I say that. But he had this lovely sort of quip saying, for the Tory leadership race, we have seen, you know, resignation, assassination and coronation, while the Labour has yet to even agree the rules of its own contest. And so, indeed, we now see Prime Minister May is, you know, making her speech, getting into Downing Street. And it's been fascinating to see how she's opened up her programme, because it's been, you hear echoes of Ed Miliband in some of the speech, her rhetoric, how she talks about the social injustices she's going to fight, how she's going to make an economy that works for everyone, which sounds a bit like Miliband when he said economy that was for all working people. And in a sense, the reason why she can get away with this is because Labour, with all respect to them, are irrelevant in the political scene. So she can steal their clothes. She can be the one nation truly cross-party leader now. And so it's going to be fascinating to see how this rolls out as she chooses a cabinet and really sets an agenda, which inevitably for the next few months will be dominated by Brexit.
I've learned from recent podcasts not to speculate too wildly on what happens next, because by the time the podcast is published, it's out of date. I think we spent 10 minutes on one show debating Boris Johnson's leadership contest, only for it to be out of date by the time we published. But Leo, I mean, what's your take on the remarks today? I mean, you were saying off air that, you know, the rhetoric's all very well and good, but of course it's delivering on that rhetoric which proves whether they're right or wrong.
It's reminiscent, I think, in lots of ways of the speech that Cameron gave at last year's party conference, which was similarly one nation and similarly talked about equality of opportunity and addressing injustices and so on. Doing that, of course, gives her lots of space to then work out the devil that are in the details of how you actually implement it. So I think it's absolutely fair to say that this is stealing Labour's clothes, but whether it's actually stealing their meal is perhaps a slightly different thing.
I mean, Asa, I'll bring you back in here. Of course, there was no, there was a coronation, there was no leadership contest. What's your sense of what the Conservative grassroots are going to think about this? One would imagine if the Labour Party had had a similar situation, there would be uproar. I mean, even when Gordon Brown took over, there were some murmurings of discontent there. Do you think the Conservative membership is sort of okay with what's happening?
I think that they are minded to understand what's happening here, and that obviously Andrea Leadsom, she was emerged transparently as someone who couldn't even handle an interview at the Times without mucking up, and so she wasn't really going to be suited for the national stage, although she is a talented politician in her way. She's not quite on the stature that Theresa May is, so hence it makes sense that they accelerated the process, and given the sort of state of semi-emergency we have with everything in flux and Brexit having to be dealt with, you know, it's good that the Prime Minister is able to be there setting an agenda, because you saw with George Osborne after the referendum, he got up and said, everything will be fine, but I won't make any of the big decisions because someone else will do them later. And so it's good there's a sort of a steady hand on the tiller now. But at the same time, this does pose risks for Prime Minister May, in that the Brexiteers will have been denied a chance to vote for one of their own. And so they, if they had been defeated in a fair, transparent contest, you know, the sort of Blair Brown thing, if they hadn't done the lovely sort of deal with each other and Blair has emphatically beaten Brown, Brown wouldn't have spent the next years, you know, being angry and wanting his chance. In the same sense, the Brexiteers will want their chance to be represented. So she's going to have to bring them on board in big, significant roles, make them feel important. And as well as that, she's going to have to satisfy in terms of what she brings back as a Brexit deal.
And I suppose it's the fashion at the moment to consider Boris Johnson's career over, but that would perhaps be a bit premature, wouldn't it? Presumably he will be the cheerleader for that side of the party.
Well, exactly. I mean, he's a big beast. People still respect him in their way, and hence that's why Michael Gove did flounder after he assassinated Boris, politically speaking, because people then did think, gosh, Michael Gove is previously a very nice man, we all respect him, but he's kind of scary now, a sort of Frank Underwood imitation for Britain. And as a result, people want to bring him in some form. Admittedly, he did fight with Theresa May in the past over things like water cannons and just jostling in that sort of way. So I imagine he's going to want to be given a big role. Mm. It's going to be interesting where the compromise is there. Perhaps something like community secretary in the end, or even then, he'll still need to be on the top table in some form.
Let's move on to the current sort of situation in Westminster, the lay of the land, if you will. Leo, there's been some polling out from ICM this week, which I think we've got here. Just one poll. There are several, and we'll come to some of that in a minute. But for those listening in, ICM had a poll this week which has the Tories on 38, Labour on 30, UKIP 15, the Liberal Democrats on 8, and of course there are other parties too. But this is kind of a national UK picture. Now, for the benefit of the people sort of listening in and watching, there are some differences in how ICM have changed their methodology. They're not relying on stated turnout anymore. There is this view in the polling industry that merely saying how likely you are to show up is not good enough anymore, frankly. They've got a sort of model based on demographics, such as age, I believe, and maybe social class, but don't quote me on that. And they're also sort of tinkering with their methodology in other ways. But nevertheless, with the caveat, as we know, voting intention polls, who believes them, eh? This is a really bad poll for this stage of the Parliament for Labour, isn't it?
For a new Prime Minister who's coming in, not on the back of an election win, but inheriting from another member of their party, It is astonishingly good position that Theresa May is coming in at. Now, this poll puts her 8 points ahead. Other polls have put her as little as one poll ahead today, but generally in the territory of 3 or 4 points ahead. And that's even before the Labour leadership shenanigans. So this is a very strong position that she's coming in at. Now, if we go back 5 years ago and compare how Labour and the Tories were set up about a year into the Parliament, June 2011, Ed Miliband, remember him, was 6 points ahead. So that's the comparison with a leader who went on to lose the election. It's a really bad time for Labour head-to-head against the Tories. And another thing that we can look at, comparing where Labour are 9 months into Corbyn's leadership with previous standings of the parties 9 months into Labour's new Labour leaders gives us Corbyn being 7 points lower than Labour have ever been whilst in opposition under a new leader. So historically, these are unprecedentedly bad positions that Labour is in.
I mean, Asa, some people have suggested there might be a snap general election, even though Theresa May has ruled that out. Given these numbers, you can understand the attraction of that proposition, can't you?
Yes, but then Theresa May would probably really sorely love to obliterate Labour right now and capitalise on all this insecurity in the party. But then she wants to get on with business. She wants to show that this is why people have invested such trust in her. So she's going to have relieved European partners by saying there's not going to be a snap general election immediately. But then it's a whole different story once the details of whatever Brexit terms she negotiates happen, because the Brexiteers here, of course, they've raised the bar really quite high in talking during the referendum campaign of just a lovely, great British deal. We'll negotiate a unique one. It will be perfect. And so as a result, Theresa, you know, she's a smart politician. She knows there are trade-offs in these sort of things. In other words, will you get absolute control over immigration? How much is control? What are we talking about exactly? You know, how much access do we get to the single market? What are the compromises here? And so as a result, people like Ian Duncan-Smith and more avowed Brexiteers, you know, will be sitting on the back benches most likely, and ready to pounce on anything that they detect as a sign of weakness and backsliding. And at the same time, of course, you know, you see that Labour then, given they're so sidelined, I mean, UKIP are going to be fast coming up the outside here.
I mean, that is an interesting debate, isn't it, Leo, UKIP? Because, I mean, there are some people that suggest, oh, well, you know, we've voted to leave the European Union, UKIP's finished. I've always been very sceptical about that, because this hint of betrayal, which Asa alludes to, certainly could live long in the memory if that, you know, does develop as a result of whatever the Brexit deal is. Likewise, we know there's massive regional differences in where UKIP gather their support. Yeah. I mean, it might be this sort of perverse situation where Theresa May is seen not to deliver the Brexit deal people wanted, and the net consequence of that is that Labour loses seats in the north of England where the Leave vote was strong. So I suppose, yes, there's threats to Theresa May's government, but there's potentially threats to Labour too. I mean, Labour's policy, for example, on Europe is going to be interesting here, isn't it?
The big downside risk here for Labour is very much the loss of working class, former supporters to UKIP in the many seats now where UKIP is second placed. And as you say, perversely, that very much now feels like a product of what the government does. Now, going back to the general election question, there's perhaps something of a paradox and a tension for the decision here for the government. A general election now or let's say in the spring, potentially absolutely destroys Labour. But those seats, many of them, aren't going to the Tories, they're going to UKIP. And if you're Theresa May, do you really want to be giving UKIP a foothold in Parliament, say 30 seats? Mm-hmm. That feels like actually quite a serious long-term risk, not just to Labour, but potentially also to other Tory seats.
Well, at the same time, we talk about UKIP getting 30 seats, but the electoral system does work against them, and there's no more Nigel, isn't there? So we can exaggerate.
It does, and it clearly did last year, but at some point you get to a tipping point where once you start gaining a few more percentage points of votes as UKIP, then you start getting a lot more seats quite quickly. Mm. And we didn't hit that tipping point, of course, last time. Mm. But it's not that far away for lots of Labour-held seats.
Mm. I mean, Asa, how worried do you think the Tories will be about UKIP? Because, of course, in the last Parliament, there are many that think that it was the rise of UKIP which ultimately led to David Cameron promising the referendum, which led to his demise in the first place. But I suppose, given that people like Mark Reckless defected and then lost his seat, obviously Douglas Carswell's still there, there may be this view in the Conservative Party that people aren't going to jump ship anymore, that's not going to happen, they've kind of neutered it, and it's almost a Labour problem now. I mean, do you think there maybe even complacency might be in the Tory party?
Well, I think they're being philosophical about this. They're not ruling anything out like this, and there's a UKIP apocalypse and all the rest of it, but because they know that inevitably Labour will be under threat in the North, and that obviously they, you know, Jeremy Corbyn can't speak to people up there, really. You know, where, yeah, UKIP are very likely, given how the race is going, to elect perhaps a Northern leader, or some Northern Farage, in a sense, who can speak their language, speak more like them, understand their concerns about immigration and all the rest, and really ramp up the tone. Because obviously there has been analysis, I think, by Ian Warren for Leave.eu, showing that Farage does put people off a tad. So UKIP would then go even more into Labour heartlands as a result. Mm. And so when we see this, I think it just comes to the context of when the Brexit terms emerge, because there's going to be a lot of sort of rhetoric about, you know, betrayal and disappointment, because that's what UKIP trade off. They love to spur this establishment stitch up that will be happening. And at the same time, Theresa May probably knows that she's going to have to, she becomes a huge pressure to seek consent from people for the terms that they, you know, that they, she comes with, back with, because Remainers will obviously not want something too abrupt. They want to still be involved with the single market. And Brexiteers, of course, will want something even more fantastic with free trade deals coming out of everyone's ears at this rate. But so it's going to be interesting to see who's happy in a way. And given she's still got a majority of 12, of course, it only takes a few Brexiteers to make mischief, and then things start getting very awkward indeed for the government.
Let's sort of pivot slightly towards the Labour Party. There's a poll by Sky Data that's come out this week, which I think is pretty damning. I mean, I think we've discussed how we think the Tories are in a strong position. But bear in mind that the last general election, obviously the voting intention polls were proven to be incorrect. There were two measures that people looked at that they suggested that should have been the ones we were looking at. Mm. One was trust on the economy, which party do you trust the most? One was who do you think would make the better prime minister? And this poll from Sky Data, which I think a lot of people have seen, shows that when asked that question, 62% pick Theresa May versus 18% that pick Jeremy Corbyn. In fact, 20% say don't know. But about two-thirds-ish are picking Theresa May instead of Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, Leo, we're going to come on to talk about the Labour Party now. But, I mean, as a scene setter, if you like, that is a really strong position for Theresa May to be in, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, clearly. Look, I don't want to bang on about this because I talked about it quite a lot last time, but I'm still not convinced that we can look at who's ahead in questions like this, the best prime minister and or best on the economy, and use that to predict an election result. I mean, you know, one thing that is on my mind when I'm looking at this, that 5 years ago Ed Miliband was 15 points behind Cameron on best prime minister. Well, now Corbyn's 44 points behind, so he's doing a lot worse. But does that mean that he's going to do 30 points worse than Miliband did at the last general election? Well, of course not. So I'll take it with a bit of a pinch of salt of saying this therefore tells us that about what's going to happen in the election. But, you know, big picture, the context is clearly dreadful in terms of the choice of prime minister, which only gets more significant as an election gets closer. And so whilst I don't think that we can use this to say this is what's going to happen in the election, clearly as an election begins to hove into view and there is a question in voters' minds of who they want in number 10 and who they see chairing the cabinet, then this kind of background thought is going to become slightly more pertinent.
And we obviously talked about the Conservatives. Let's move on to the Labour Party. It's almost easy to forget they have their own problems at the moment with all the stuff that's going on. Mm. Now, Jeremy Corbyn faces a leadership contest of some kind. We're not 100% sure whether it will be Angela Riegel, whether it will be Owen Smith, a combination of the two. But let's talk a little bit about his prospects in that, because I think there is this consensus that he wins re-election comfortably. But there are some signs, Leo, aren't there, that his popularity is waning. There is this poll that's come out today from Ipsos Mori, which shows his satisfaction ratings amongst Labour voters. Now, it should be, we have to be very clear, these are not necessarily people that are going to vote in the Labour leadership contest. These are Labour voters. But for the first time in a very long time, Labour voters are more dissatisfied than satisfied with their leaders' how they're doing in their job, their leaders' performance in their job. This, I think, speaks to a trend, Leo, doesn't it, that Jeremy Corbyn's reputation is taking a hit.
Yes, absolutely. And what we see is that there has been, for the first time, 2 months of quite significant consecutive falls in his satisfaction rating. So it's been going up and down, but now for the first time it's gone below 50%, and we've got more people dissatisfied.
So it's just now, to jump in there briefly before you carry on. So just for the people listening in, satisfied 45%, dissatisfied 48%, don't know 7%. So a very divided voter base there.
Yeah. And this argument has been getting a bit of pushback today from Corbyn supporters who've been saying, look, this isn't unprecedented. Lots of other prime ministers and leaders have had approval ratings this low. But the point is, none of them have had approval ratings this low so early in their leadership. So, sure, Thatcher in the sort of fag end of her premiership was this unpopular, and so have other leaders of the opposition been, but not only 9 months in. And that's what makes this really significant.
I tweeted earlier this week, Asa, that one of the, you know, if you I paraphrase a bit, but you know, this week has shown very clearly the differences between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, hasn't it? You know, if a Conservative Party had a leader with ratings like that, they would be gone almost overnight, wouldn't they?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's William Hague who did say that the Tory Party is like a monarchy punctuated by regular regicides, and that they know how to do coups. They get them out if they're incompetent. That's why they, you know, after Sir William Hague, they cleave through these leaders all the way until they found one that would work. David Cameron, so that the recipe is in it. And at the same time with Corbyn, there's the curious thing with Labour in that they're kind of held back by this emotional attachment to, you know, oh, it's the movement, you know, I can't do this. They sort of fretted about Ed Miliband, they didn't do much. You had just John Mann and Simon Dancher as the only ones speaking out and saying, there's a train coming here, it's going to crash.
don't forget James Pennell trying to take down Gordon.
Oh, yes, and then they all just thought, we can't, you know, it's not brotherly, it's not comradely, you know, it's, and as a result, yeah, with Gordon, with Miliband, it just, it's a history of these things. And so at the same time, now, kudos to Andrew Regal and Owen Smith for speaking out. Admittedly, they've taken their time. And I'm just bemused that, you know, speaking with us, sort of trying to understand how these things work here, I don't get how you would put two non-Corbyn candidates against Corbyn to try and beat him, in a sense, because one of them's going to have to pull out, or they're going to have to work together on this. Given even the polls, they say that, you know, that Corbyn is going to win if it came down to a face-off against them. And as we see this, it genuinely is a state of trying to stimulate and get the activists in, get them paying the £25 to the votes, or the £2 Unite affiliate scheme, as they seem to be sharing. And it's going to be a race, because, of course, on Twitter we've got the competition of hashtag Save Corbyn versus hashtag Save Labour. And the problem is you've seen lots of rallies of Save Corbyn, of, you know, pro-Corbyn rallies, but not many for the Blairites and moderates, in a sense, because the one thing the hard left can do really well is organise. And so there's going to be a bit of a race against time here.
But then, Leo, the mechanics of this race are quite important, aren't they? And so there was this sense last night, I think, after the NEC meeting that I wouldn't say Corbyn had snapped defeat from the jaws of victory, but having been put on the ballot and left the meeting, subsequent rules were agreed that maybe didn't favour him.
Yeah, I think that I think that was the view last night. I think the mechanics of that have been slightly scotched. I think his supporters also voted for that. There was a large enough margin that had he not been in the room, had he been in the room, then that would still have happened. I think his supporters were also broadly reasonably happy with it. So I'm going to make the terrible mistake here, no doubt, of disagreeing with Stephen Bush on an issue of Labour Party mechanics and outcomes. So I'm almost certainly wrong. But I think that the changes last night really bring the race back into the balance in quite a significant way. So the last poll of all members, which was in June, so before, I think it was around the time of the referendum, had Corbyn beating Eagle by 50 to 40. So reasonably comfortable, but, you know, not a huge lead. Now, his support is hugely concentrated in people who joined the party after May 2015. Longer-standing members quite strongly backed Eagle. Now, the changes now are going to cut a significant chunk of the post-May 2015 members. How many of them? I don't know. Clearly, a lot of those members will have joined
to vote for him in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but then a lot of them, probably if you're joining to vote for him, you joined as a supporter. Probably others then joined in September or whenever, fairly soon after he came in. The cutoff is mid-January. I think it's hard to dispute that a lot of people, a lot of the joiners who came to the party January to July would have been people who were enthused by Corbyn. Them being cut out surely has to harm his chances amongst this electorate. And given it's only 50 to 40, then it seems to me that these changes are potentially bringing it to quite a close point. Now, that's not to say that I think Eagle's definitely going to win, but I think, God help me, Stephen Bush and others who say that this is certainly going to be the case, that Corbyn is absolutely going to be re-elected, are being too confident.
I mean, there is an issue here, though, about who the candidate is, isn't there, Asa?
Yes.
Because you mentioned a moment ago that, you know, you didn't think it was a good idea to have two candidates. I think there is a sort of Westminster consensus, at least, that one of them will drop out, although knowing the Labour Party,
unless
let's not take anything...
Unless they want to move and have Corbyn stay in.
Well, yeah. Knowing the Labour Party, let's not take anything for granted in terms of competence. But we have Owen Smith and Angela Eagle. My view would be that Owen Smith would be a better candidate without risking to project too much on him. Mm. He's a bit back to the 80s with a Welsh leader taking on a new Iron Lady, but leaving that to one side. He doesn't have the baggage of Iraq, and Angela Eagle voted for the Iraq War. Mm. She was the one that came out first, and I wonder if there's something psychological about the fact that she was the first person to bravely and commendably stick her head above the parapet. Mm. Maybe she almost takes the flak for doing so, and Owen Smith can come in as a sort of reluctant unity candidate. I mean, I suppose the Tories won't mind who they face, really, but for me, it feels like Owen Smith would be the more difficult candidate for Theresa May to run against of the three.
I mean, while they're looking inwards, obviously the Tories are quietly happy because they can get on with everything and Brexit and all the sort of nitty-gritty. So in the meantime, when we look at the Labour race, I would say, yes, with Angela Eagle, she's been battered, sadly, by the sort of Corbynite abuse and all the sort of stuff she's had. Because this is, like, sadly what happens now in the party when you stick your head above the parapet. Mm-hmm. You're going to get this flak. And, you know, she sort of knows that. And obviously there's a tragic sight of what Andrea Leadsom had announced her resignation just when she was making her speech and launch. So no one sort of really was impressed or cared very much.
Or any journalists there.
Yeah, they all left. And so as a result, she sort of knows that she almost has to just get him out in a sense, in some way. It's almost like, to put it very politely, a sort of kamikaze operation in a way, in that, she knows she can't sort of, she has to unite the party. The Corbynites are furious at her then. There'll still be members. She has to deal with them somehow. So if then she can clear the way and Owen Smith comes through relatively unbloodied, then so much the better.
Mm. Mm. But I suppose, Leo, one of the problems Labour has now is that there is, you know, David Cameron did it in PMQs today. The Conservatives have had two female leaders, Labour have had zero. There will be a lot of resentment in the Labour Party if the one female candidate has to stand aside for Owen Smith, even if there is a legitimate reason for that in the sense of the Iraq vote issue is a credible reason why you might not think that Angela Eagle is the best candidate of the two. It's maybe not a great look, and maybe it will cause some consternation amongst some moderates, won't it?
I'm really torn about this because I think if Labour wants to have the best chance, or if the part of the Labour Party that doesn't like Corbyn wants to have the best possible chance of beating him, then sadly history suggests that their ideal candidate is a man. I think the record of last year's elections are fairly shameful for Labour being a party that believes in gender equality. I think it's very difficult to make the case, for example, why Diane Abbott did so badly in London when Corbyn, who shares all of her policies, did so well. Mm. I think, sadly, it really seems to be the case that the Labour membership has a problem electing women. Now, do you use this election as the time to break that and to say, great, this is time to elect a woman and we're going to go for it? Perhaps, and that could be the thing that changes it. But there's also a very strong argument that you say the anti-Corbyn rebels have to put up the single candidate who's got the best chance of winning.
Mm. I want to come back to that in a moment, but there is some other data that we were looking at off-air, Leo, that this poll that I think Ian Warren, who was mentioned earlier, did, who runs the Twitter account Election Data, which I'm sure people that watch and listen to this will follow, if not they should, of kind of trade union members. And I guess we're talking about whether Corbyn can be beaten, and you mentioned some things earlier. This poll is quite interesting because it seems to suggest that lots of trade union members think he should stand down. So, for example, do you think Jeremy Corbyn should or should not continue as leader of the Labour Party and fight the next general election? Amongst a host of union members, CWU, Usdaw, GMB, Unison, Unite, roughly about 6 in 10 thinking he should stand down before the general election. Mm. How seriously do we take some of this data? Because you know, what is a union member and what is someone that actually will be relevant to this contest, frankly?
In theory, it's really significant. YouGov's analysis of the last leadership election had 17% of the electorate being affiliates, so many of them will be union members, and that 17% backed Corbyn. They were 58% in support of Corbyn. Now, in this latest poll, we've got, even before, and the poll was taken before Eagle was endorsed as a candidate, or was the put forward as a candidate, had even split between them backing Eagle and backing Corbyn. So it certainly suggests, at first glance, that support for Corbyn has fallen amongst union members who will be voting. Problem is, so all of these people, pretty much, give or take, will be eligible to vote. Question is, who among them are actually going to vote? So if you look at this poll, only about half of them actually voted Labour in the last general election. If you look at the affiliates who voted in the last leadership election, they overwhelmingly did vote Labour. So it seems to me that not all of these are voting, and the ones who are voting are people who are more sympathetic to Labour. Now, that might well mean that they're more sympathetic to Labour's leader as well. So it may be that although this looks really bad for Corbyn in that it suggests that he's lost a lot of the support that he had last year, it might be that actually those who turn up on the day, or rather put in their postal ballot, or fill it in online, will be those who are more in favour of him. We just don't know.
I want to come back to the Labour leadership contest in terms of the sort of the characters in it and the issues. I'll bring Asa back in here. I mean, one of my observations has been throughout this whole process, Labour is clearly tearing itself apart, and yet they haven't actually engaged in the major issue of the last month, which is Brexit, which is the vote to leave the European Union. And I don't profess to have a particular solution to this, but there is a really difficult strategic question to answer, isn't there, here? Mm. Which is, does the Labour Party accept the referendum result and sort of embrace the terms of Brexit and sort of ultimately act as the responsible opposition that puts forward their plans for that? Mm. Or does the Labour Party not accept the result and try and harness the so-called 48% and use that as their route back to power? And it's a really difficult strategic question, isn't it? Particularly when you look at the northern working class vote that clearly went for Leave.
Mm. I mean, it's quite something when you see that, as regards their stance, that UKIP and the Lib Dems have more of an advanced policy on this issue. You know, the Lib Dems, oh my gosh, that's terrible, let's get rid of Brexit now. UKIP, yippee, let's get on with this. And so with Labour, they have to work this out. It's been just as confused as during the referendum campaign, you know, whether it's actually a good thing or not, what they do. I mean, because obviously you've got people like Corbyn who probably are quite secretly happy with this and just want to get rid of
Corbyn and McDonald seem to have moved on quite quickly.
Yes, it's taken it in their stride, really, because I think they regard it, as you saw in the referendum campaign, as a Tory thing. A blue-on-blue Tory Brexit was the term they like to use. And so they're sort of being philosophical. But again, the unions, of course, they'll be very worried about this. And so it's telling the lack of leadership that they have yet to really come through with a unified line on this. Mm. And that's obviously why, you know, they're allowed to be in such disarray right now. And the thing that struck me with the last poll on the popularity and how much Labour supporters thought, you know, how well they thought Corbyn was doing, was just that, yes, if it's happening this early on, this sort of perception that he is bad. I mean, obviously, first impressions are fatal in a sense. You know, people thought Nick Clegg was a bit of a traitor in tuition fees, and that, you know, he never shook that off. In the same sense, Ed Miliband, you just thought, oh, David Miliband, you stabbed your brother in the back. You know, you're a bit gawky. That's the thing. So it's hard to see how this improves for them.
I suppose, Leo, though, if we're talking about the issues and how do you remove Corbyn as Labour leader, I think I'm right in saying that in the YouGov poll recently, 90% of Labour members indicated that they voted Remain. And that's different, of course, to Labour voters. Yeah. But still, if you're trying to create a so-called wedge issue, an issue to try and campaign against Corbyn on, presumably some sort of either rejoining the EU or going in that direction is what you do it on, but then it's quite difficult how you do that without looking like you're ignoring the will of the British people, I suppose.
Mm. Well, there aren't many wedge issues where the anti-Corbyn rebels are on the same side of the members and against Corbyn, so it sort of feels this has to be the one that they take him on with if there's going to be a policy contest, which I think is fairly debatable. I think both sides, well, the rebels will largely try and avoid getting too drawn into policy. But you're right. I mean, they are not on the same side as 52% of the country. If they do that, and that's going to be troublesome. It seems to me that an angle they might go down, which I don't know how much success they'll have, but is trying to reframe this as essentially a good Brexit versus a bad Brexit. And, you know, Asa, you referred to the sort of the Tory Brexit argument, which clearly didn't have much cut through. Hmm. But it seems that that's the place that, if it can work, is a nice space for Labour to be in, because clearly lots of people who voted for Brexit, who are Labour's natural working class supporters, still want things like employee protection and good minimum wage and good environmental protections and so on. So if you can frame the argument as about good Brussels versus bad Brussels stuff, then in a way, you don't have to spend so much time talking about freedom of movement, which is clearly the killer thing. But if that becomes a different conversation about, say, points-based systems and so on, then you might be able to find some way of weaving through that and still having a dividing line that possibly, if it goes really well, and this might be fantasy land, starts to cause problems for the Tories, because that's clearly the division that cuts through the Tory party in a way that doesn't really cut through Labour. So Labour probably are united on this sort of we want a good Brexit, whereas the Tories, that's clearly the division between the Brexiteers or the different kinds of Brexiteers and the Remainers about what this means.
They didn't know what a good Brexit means. I mean, you look at the referendum campaign on the Titanic issue of immigration. The Remainers just fell apart thanks to Labour, in the sense of Tom Watson and Andy Burnham suddenly saying, oh, we need more curbs. And the Ed Balls saying, yeah, let's just do that several days before the referendum campaign. Given it had been identified that immigration was their weakest point, you know, they just ruined it, arguably, for them. And then so as a result, we now see they want to help from the sidelines. Yeah, they're going to be irrelevant during this. They just have to sort of say, oh, well, you know, less of the free market stuff if possible. You know, they're not contributing. The real opposition to this for Theresa May will be the Brexiteers on her own benches.
Let's finish with Theresa May, the woman of the hour, of course. So I'll get the final words to you, Asa. I mean, what is her agenda now in the sort of first week or two? Obviously, she picks a cabinet. But, I mean, what are her strategic goals in the sort of opening sort of moments, if you like, of her tenure?
Well, she's certainly going to have to make the Brexiteers feel included, and in terms of not just one nation for Britain, but also one party for you know, for the Tories, because obviously historically Europe has now claimed, you know, has ended the careers of many of the recent Tory prime ministers, and so she's going to have to try and last as long as possible before the sort of the rot sets in and the suspicion, the fighting, and try and avoid any of that. Because if she can, that'll be remarkable. Because obviously, once there's glimmers of these deals, you know, David Cameron, she will remember this vividly. Struggled with the renegotiation. There was this perception that it was a fool's errand, and that every month he was just being mocked by EU leaders. So she's going to have to do much better than this. You know, almost get out Margaret Thatcher's old handbag and really show them, give them what for.
Well, unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this week. I think we've gone over our sort of allotted time. But Asa and Leo, thank you very much. That is all we've got time for this week's PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters show. Certainly a momentous day in British politics. Join us next week when we'll be talking about Theresa May's new cabinet, but also looking at events across the pond where we should have at least one VP nominee picked.